What time is it, you wonder? Well, it's time for Drinks with Tony on KPCR LP Santa Cruz 101.9 FM. Ba 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 da ba bum sound. Tony Duchesne here. Welcome to episode 133 of Drinks with Tony. My guest is Jason Novak, whose books include Et tu, Brute and Baseball Epic. His latest project is illustrating a book called Ascent by Joe Frank. You know, right before pandemic, I was in New York City and I was on the set of the TV show Madam Secretary as they shot their last episode. I got to shadow Eric Stoltz, and he was doing while he was prepping and directing. And the point of the story here is I was at lunch with him and the producers and crew as we were doing a location scout. And the executive producer was sitting across the table from me, and I'd been friendly with him during the week. And he asked me, "So, Tony, what's your story?" See, in Hollywood, everyone's always talking about how to pitch themselves, pitch their work, pitch what you do, what's your elevator pitch. Essentially, it feels just so inauthentic and gross that I shy really far away from it. So when he asked, "Tony, what's your story?" I choked on my lobster bisque and I looked at Eric. I was like, "Seriously?" I didn't say anything, and then Eric said, "Tony and I worked on a movie together." And then we talked about that for a little bit during lunch. What I didn't realize was I was wrong in that situation, because it is an important question. What's your story? I'm not going to like have an elevator pitch ready. And if I see Cameron Crowe checking if avocados are ripe at Gelson's, I'm not going to go up to him and go, "Well, hey, I want to tell you my origin story." That would be being a whore. But during COVID, I've had a lot of time to we all have had a lot of time to think about things, and probably way too much time to think about things. But one of the things I've been thinking about is that I shouldn't have acted like a douche when that guy asked me, and we were already friendly. We'd been hanging out for the week, and he just said, "Tony, what's your story?" It's a valid question. And I could have answered it in an elegant way, like Eric did for me. And poor Eric was probably rolling his eyes in the back of his head thinking, "Tony, this isn't one of the bad ones. Get up to speed, fella." Regret. I mean, we've all had a long time to look back at regret. And hopefully we're changing our patterns. I'm trying to change mine. I gotta say, when I hear any writer or producer doing a panel discussion and talking about the importance of the elevator pitch, I still want to puke my guts out. But we all have our stories, and they're not elevator pitches. They're what people want to hear. They want to understand. We want to understand each other. They don't have to be fancy. They can be as simple as, "I'm from a suburb of San Francisco." And that tells a story right there. When I add that I grew up in the suburb in the 1980s, if anyone's familiar with it, they'll know it was probably dreary. It was before the dot-com era. And there's a story there. It's like, that's what you are. And they're right. And smash cut. There's a wonderful scene in that movie Swingers where Jon Favreau goes up to the girl at the party and he finally gets the courage to say hi. And he says, "Hi." And she just looks at him and says, "What do you drive?" And then she ignores him because he has a Chevy Cavalier. But that Chevy Cavalier has a story to tell about his journey in life. I'm 51 and I drive a Honda Accord with 200,000 miles on it. That's a story there. Why do I make the choice to drive that car when I can afford a newer car? What's important to me in life? Just that decision I make on what car I drive kind of tells a story. What I've learned is if someone asks me, "What's your story?" especially on a lunch with a crew for a TV show, they're not asking for a pitch. They're not stuck in a production. They have been stuck in a production van with you, and you just happen to sit across the table from them, and they want to know. They want to start up a conversation. So I could have told them, "I worked on a movie with Eric, and I grew up in San Francisco." That would have been elegant. But then we go back to the terrible question, like you get on job interviews where they say, "So tell us about yourself." But in the job interview, that's kind of a negotiation already. You're asking them for something. I want a steady paycheck and an employer. So of course I'm going to tell myself about you, about me, and how I fit into you. That feels a little more douchey. Growing up in a dreary suburb of San Francisco in the 1980s in a working class family kind of tells a story right there of why I would choke on lobster bisque at a restaurant in upstate New York when an executive producer asked me the question, "What's your story?" I got issues. I still have my own issues to deal with. And it's all about like how I grew up, where I grew up, and to not assume people are asking me for anything more or wanting to give me anything. They just really don't want to know, what's your story? It's okay. Now there's this guy, Jason Novak. Let me tell you, he's got some stories.
Hi, I'm Jason Novak, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show. Yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Jason Novak. He's the illustrator of the new book by Joe Frank entitled Ascent. Jason, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm all right. How did you hook up with Joe Frank? I love that guy.
Through the mysterious alchemy of email.
Yeah?
He was ill already when I contacted him. And, you know, I grew up on his shows. And it was always at the back of my mind, especially as my cartooning career picked up, that maybe he was someone I'd want to try and work with. And I felt like when I realized the situation he was in, I felt like I needed to act immediately. And luckily, he was receptive to it.
So it took him being ill before you got in touch with him.
Yeah, I thinking back on it, I regret that this is the sort of thing, if an idea pops into your head and there's no, the only consequence is that someone will say no, try it out anyway.
Exactly, because there's got to be some regret there. It would almost, here's what I would do in that situation. I would almost rather him say no and go, oh, good, glad I didn't ask him earlier. But then when he says yes, you know, this is to me in like other areas of my life, then it's just like, oh, crap, I could have asked him 5 years ago and he probably would have said yes. This is what goes through my head.
It's possible that he might have softened to this kind of project precisely because of the situation he was in.
Yeah.
I know he famously was very demanding of the people that he worked with in performing.
Uh-huh.
So his wife, Michael, has told me that it was a double-edged situation, that a lot of the book was posthumous for him. She said that we'd probably still be working on the beginning preliminaries if he was involved.
So interesting. Because like when you listen to his old show, I mean, I've listened to almost every, I have the whole archive. I'm a nutter on his stuff. It seems so off the cuff. And some of it was really off the cuff.
Right. Yeah. And so, you didn't necessarily know. And he was good at hiding whether or not it was improvised.
Yeah. Do you remember the show where he called up his ex-girlfriends and sang to them?
Yes. I that was probably one of the earliest ones I heard. And it's the kind of thing you don't forget.
Yeah. I was almost crying. She's like, and then the last girl's like, was I the only girl you called? And he goes, yeah.
Well, the funny thing, I was definitely a kid, like maybe even prepubescent. So I kind of lacked some of that, the self-consciousness that you might have. If I think about now calling some ex-girlfriends, it's mortifying. But back then I probably heard it as well. Yeah, he's calling his friends. That's just what you do, right? I'm 10. So
did you grow up in Los Angeles, or where did you hear him out of?
Well, I grew up in Concord, which is sort of, close enough that we picked up the signal from KPFA in Berkeley.
Oh, he was on KPFA. I grew up in Millbrae. So.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I used to go to the Concord Pavilion when I was, in my early days. I remember seeing Oingo Boingo there, Greg Kin Band. Who else did I see? Yeah, Concord Pavilion was like the place. It was the big trek trip for us.
Well, the funny thing is, the first show I ever went to there was actually Prairie Home Companion.
Oh, wow.
So
how old were you?
Little foreshadowing there. I was in high school. Definitely about the uncoolest thing you could do as a teenager.
But the coolest thing you could do in your 30s. See, you were way ahead of me because I didn't know who Joe Frank was until I was about 28, 29. And then I started to get all the old tapes and hear all his old stuff. And friends made CD, you know, back when we burned CDs. So I listened to the shows on CD. And that's, I didn't even know he was on KPFA. I just knew that he was on KCRW in LA. So.
Yeah, I know there were just affiliates around here and there throughout the country that would pick him up. And I don't know how he negotiated that or if he was even involved or people, it was just word of mouth. But I mean, what a blessing or maybe a curse. I don't know. I was a young, impressionable kid flipping around the dial out of boredom in the evening. My mom worked in San Francisco, so I was at home alone a lot. And I just one night I found this voice and it sounded like something was suddenly wrong with the radio. Because it was not a radio. It was not like anything I'd ever heard before.
Instant
addiction.
Yeah, that happened to me when I was a kid.
I think that's a lot of people. I think a lot of people.
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, that was the end of your sentence?
Oh, I think that's what happened to a lot of people. A lot of people ended up fans of him. You either get it right away. It just hits something, some part of your core just responds to it viscerally, or people kind of scrunch their nose at it and they're like, what?
Exactly. Did you ever get to meet him and talk to him in person, or was this all?
No, it was all through email, unfortunately. So, at some point after this project got rolling, I became kind of an obsessive piecing together a picture of him. You know, when I was younger, when the World Wide Web was still kind of a new idea, there were like some cryptic nuggets of information about him bouncing around on the internet. And it, in a way, it just made him more mysterious. But now we've all been just so completely saturated with it that you can eliminate almost all of the mystery. So I've gotten to know him pretty well in absentia at this point through the internet.
Yeah. And he lives on.
Yes, for sure.
Did I saw him live once. He came to San Francisco to the Great American Music Hall and played two nights and they sold out almost instantly. And I got tickets for one of the nights. Did you ever see him like do his read live and do his stories live?
Just the YouTube clips. Okay. I remember when he came to San Francisco, and I think it was at the back of my head, oh, maybe this is something I should look into or try to go to. And as again, this is one of those situations where I should have just pushed myself. I didn't go. Man. It sounds like it would have been difficult to get in anyway.
It was, well, I had two tickets and I was married at the time to someone who wasn't really, didn't even give a crap. Right. So I should have taken you. I wish we had known each other, because then you could have come with me and they would have been two appreciative fellas just soaking in the night.
A lot of partners are kind of left sort of dumbfounded by it. I think this is a classic Joe Frank fan experience.
I should have divorced her that night. I mean, that's a telling thing, right? If you can't get into this, it's just not going to work out, you know. Here's half of my money. Talk to you later. Go ahead. What were you saying?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, the reason I had the audacity to even suggest doing this with him was that, you know, he had a book of stories that came out in 93 that it seemed to get in some places good reviews, but it didn't sell that well. And the negative reviews all kind of said, well, you really have to hear his voice and you need the music loops to fully appreciate a Joe Frank story. And I thought, well, if his stuff is ever going to exist on the page, maybe it needs something to help give it the space and the atmosphere that radio provides you as a listener. And so it just seemed like the best feasible way to do that was with cartoons, with some kind of illustration. That was going to be my fallback argument if I felt like I needed to advocate for it. But
your first, when did he say yes? How fast did he say yes when you reached out to him?
Well, the first thing I did was there was a tiny little vignette he posted online it was probably just like 12 lines or something like that. And I right away, that's when you do short comics and cartoons, 12 lines is perfect. You've got right there, you have one piece that you can send around. And so I thought that, yeah, I can do this. I understand this, the logic of a piece that short very easily becomes a comic strip. And so I suggested we do that. It got published in the Paris Review website. And at that point, he sent me a manuscript. He says, as it happens, I have a whole collection of these. I was looking through that when, unfortunately, he went to the hospital for the last time. And when he died, I kind of just stepped back and let his family do what they needed to do. When his wife came back to me a little bit later to say, I'm ready to look at this project again, the original idea had been that I would just illustrate the stories like an illustrated book. So there'd be a picture here and there, but it wouldn't be picture heavy. She didn't have an agent. I certainly didn't know anyone. I'm not like an industry insider. So I became Joe Frank's agent, going to every publishing place I could think of and where I kind of knew someone. And at the end of the day, it ended up being Fantagraphics. So I knew it had to be a comic book. And so suddenly I had the task of pulling out about 10% of the full manuscript. So at the end of the day, this is actually just a small fraction of the stuff that he wanted to see published. But it's probably for the best, because the comics, like I said, give it that kind of environment and space that comes the closest I can think of to the atmosphere of radio. If it had just been text here and there, it might not have been quite as immersive.
Yeah. Does that mean there's more project to this in the future?
It might depend on how well this book does.
Okay. And what other?
It's very hard to read. I know even Gary.
Go ahead.
Gary Groth at Fantagraphics was himself a little unsure about the prospects of this book. He said that, you know, that Joe Frank has two fans. The problem with them is that they are fringe, like dark corner personalities. And I have found a lot of Joe Frank fans, but it wasn't easy. And so gathering them together in one place where you can say, here's something you might be interested in, that's not going to, they're not easy to herd.
Yeah, that's Joe Frank interesting. Fans. It's so intriguing, because I remember the Joe Frank two shows in San Francisco were announced, and then there was no advertising and it immediately sold out. And it was, I think it's there. And it might be interesting how this book does when all of a sudden, you know, maybe 3 months from now, it kind of gets into the zeitgeist, and then they'll be like, oh crap, second print run, you know?
That's what I'm hoping for.
Yeah. We want the publishers to be like, oh crap, send it to the presses. We got to go again.
So yeah, in the meantime, it's just kind of, you know, the promotion, which, you know, for a creator is not always easy. And especially when it's your own work, that's the hardest, because then there's some guilt involved, or just like you're embarrassed that you kind of feel like this huckster, like selling wares out of the back of your car or whatever. I mean, but it helps having a collaborator, because at least then you can think of it as advocating for the other guy. It's not just a purely selfish. You know,
the promotion process it sucks beyond belief. I wish everyone could just find stuff and go, oh, this is intelligent and intriguing. Go ahead.
I managed to avoid Twitter for years and years, and I started an account in December. I think of it as the sort of place where you get chewed up and spit out. But I, early on in this experiment with Twitter, I encountered another writer who is just shamelessly posting a link to his book on every tweet that goes viral in an attempt to sell it. And in a weird way, it gave me the courage. I thought, if this guy can humiliate himself publicly so consistently, then why can't I?
Well, that's great news because this airs this week on Wednesday, and I'm going to tag you then in the Twitter. So there'll be a tag coming your way. In the social media stuff, you know, people like, you know, there's so much bowl on there, but I think like people will try to like engage with you in a I'm going to attack you kind of way. And just right. What I always do is pull back and go, oh yeah, you might be right. You know, just de-escalate everything. And then they realize, oh, this isn't what I wanted out of this. And I actually have empathy for the guy. Crap, you know, so.
Yeah, I that is kind of my own strategy. Part of that has to do with being so indecisive. And so I can walk into a room with a strong opinion and be talked out of it very quickly.
But when it comes to illustrations, I'm sure you'll fight. Go ahead.
Instincts take over at that point. Yeah. And, you know, in my case, the way it manifests is if something isn't going to work, my body will just shut down and I won't be able to draw at all. So it's my better nature, my subconscious taking over at that point.
And how do you keep your subconscious? How do you tap the subconscious when you're working on your illustrations?
I try to let things just kind of happen and unfold. There's not very much planning that goes into stuff. But it's great if I'm, you know, and I do frequently collaborate. So it wasn't a totally new experience to work with Joe's material. Even so, with the script, I can kind of, I don't know how the page is going to look, but I'll just start. And I've kind of come up with this weird sort of geometric strategy for doing the pages where I work on very small pieces of paper and then kind of lace them together to build a comic page. And so that what that does is it gives me the freedom to just create as many images as I need to and then figure out how they fit. So it's almost like working with collage, but instead of cutting things out, it's my own work. So it's, yeah, but it isn't, it's definitely intuitive. I don't even necessarily know what's going to be in that panel when I lay the pen down.
And how large are the pieces of paper
they're post-it notes, 3 by 3, 3 inches by 3 inches.
So you're working with great go ahead.
Yeah. Flare pens on yellow paper. That with glue on the back.
and so when you're working on something that's that small, does it feel like, for me, or I'll explain me, maybe this question will sound half intelligent, but for me, I need to write, I need to use my, I have my pens, which is this pen that I use for writing all the time. And my legal pad. And that's, it has to be that. All first drafts have to be that because it keeps the preciousness out of the situation. It's, you know, people try to give me these nice pens, these beautiful journals. I can't write in that because then I'm like, I have to produce something that's brilliant. But if I have tons of legal pads and tons of pens, the preciousness goes away and I can tap what I need to tap to write, which most of it is crap. But in your scenario, is it kind of the same when you just have your post-it note?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So one of the things, you know, I came into art and cartooning very obliquely. It was not something that I thought about as a kid. I was kind of ignorant about art and into my early adulthood, really, I had no point of reference and I was never really into comics as a kid. So what one thing when I finally did start exploring comics, this has happened. I've heard in interviews, people who do it the way I do it, they don't get the proper grounding, so they're not taught what the correct kind of paper is, or the fact that a lot of cartooning you start with underdrawing, which is pencil that then is erased away after you ink everything. I didn't know any of that, so I just started drawing on like typing paper. I thought when I would look at a page of comics, I thought, this was something that someone just sat down and drew without any like tricks. And it was, in one way it was kind of like, if it was a very defeating feeling to think, how can I ever get that good? But at some point I got over that. but the post-it notes, that it is, it's all about that disposability. If I make a mistake, it is no loss at all to just crumble it up and throw it across the room and start over. And so, yeah, in a way it frees up. And I've had that same experience. People have given me stacks of nice paper or the, you know, fountain pens with the, you know, the gold plating or whatever. And it just, that they feel like museum pieces and they are not to be used or handled in any way. It's a completely shuts you down to use that, or at least me. And it sounds like you, I like the cheap throwaway materials are ideal. And it, interestingly, the yellow paper, I've heard that it actually helps with looking at the page, that it's actually good for your vision to see black on yellow versus black on white. I know that James Thurber used yellow legal pad paper for his cartoons. And he actually had really, so I gathered that was part of his strategy for overcoming his own limitations.
Interesting. Yeah, I have so many limitations. I should just be doing everything on yellow. If I could do my whole life on yellow pad, I think things would clear up. So when did you go, wait, you know what? I'm into illustrating. I think this is a thing.
Well, it's thanks to a relationship that was ultimately doomed. But while I was still trying to make it work, my girlfriend at the time was going to grad. We grew up in the Bay Area. She was going to grad school in Oregon, and I was a high school dropout. And so she kind of, I mean, this was kind of wise of her. She said, if you're going to follow me to another state, I want you to at least do something productive with yourself. And so I thought, well, she's going to school, I'll go to school. But being a high school dropout, the only thing I was really qualified to go to was art school. So to satisfy her criteria, I enrolled in art school in Oregon, and I kept that up for a couple semesters. And I again, like having no real understanding of what art was or how it worked or even really knowing what my goal was. It turns out the school I went to was a traditional painting school. So what I got without even expecting it was a classical education in what's called foundation art. So like the life drawing classes and color theory and stuff like that. So it ended up being really useful, though even I also dropped out of art school eventually, and still hadn't formulated any kind of plan. But I ended up in another relationship with someone who went to grad school in London, and I followed her out there. And I had put the art down. I thought it was just this weird encounter I'd had, and I wasn't going to do anything more with it. I was trying to be a writer at the time. And suddenly here I was following someone to London, and I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll be the next T.S. Eliot, some absurd junk like that. It was there, not really having a plan, kind of wandering around. If you have nothing to do in a place like that, you end up in pubs. So I was sitting in pubs with this writing material, and at some point I hit a wall with it. Writing just didn't feel right anymore. And so I started drawing cartoons, and that's when I realized something just clicked. I remember the first day I sat down and really on purpose tried to draw a cartoon. It was like something in my head was singing. And the next day I put something together and sent it to Private Eye magazine. And at the end of the day, this was actually, they required you had to send it on a fax machine. This was about 15 years ago. So even then, fax machines were kind of old. But I remember by the end of the day, I got a fax back saying, nope, no thanks. We don't want this. But so I discovered not only that cartooning was going to be an addiction for me, but that rejection would also be an addiction. Because after getting that first rejection, I've been thirsting for more ever since from magazines.
I think, you know, if people aren't in the, aren't you doing creative things with their lives, I don't think they realize how much rejection it is, how much of a beatdown it is, even when people say yes, and you're like, great. and then it's still rejection until you get to the final.
Yeah. Then, I'm almost suspicious when they say yes. I think I've misheard them, or they've mistaken me for someone else.
Yeah. What was so that I love that, you know, because it's all storytelling. Everything's storytelling. And you were trying to get your story down as a writer, and then you realized, oh no, I need to get my stories down as an illustrator.
Yeah. And it, what I've found more and more as time goes on, though I like writing and I certainly enjoy working with words, I'm a very visual thinker. In some ways, this is kind of a big debate, I know, in philosophical circles, how much thought is driven by language. And I really feel like there's an element of my thinking that is not tethered by language. And I think that language was, in a way, was the things that I was trying to express, language was actually just weighing it down and making it impossible. Because I even remember that the first day in London, when I was in that pub drawing cartoons, they were things that right away would be hard to put in words. So then maybe that's why my head was singing, because I finally found something that felt like a real release after trying for years to express it some other way.
It makes sense, because even like sometimes words won't capture the story, even in music, you know, when you like, I don't think like a musician, but I'm around people, you know, who are musicians, and they don't think like writers, but they can tell you the story by creating the music. And it's just, it's so beautiful there's a beauty with words, and there's that beauty beyond the words of the connect, just connecting a story. There's not words for it, you know?
Right. Yeah. I know. And I love music. I have, you know, I've all my life, I've gathered many, many, to the bane of people around me, stacks of records and CDs and things. But it is, yeah, when you get into that zone, and this happens to me all the time, where I'm listening to a piece of music and I want so badly to somehow translate it into an image, but it sometimes is impossible, because music is such a specific kind of experience. But it's, what a wonderful one. And certainly it was integral to Joe Frank's work. I know that his shows would be so different without the music. And I know that it was a major focus for him. It wasn't like random stuff that he was pulling out of the bin. He really thought hard about what would work with his stories. Almost like film.
Yeah. Yeah. And even the medium of film is just, it always blows my mind. I mean, well, I teach screenwriting, so I'm watching films over and over and over again. And my students go, "Do we really have to watch Jim Carrey and Yes Man again?" And I'm like, "You idiots, I've watched it 10 times for this damn lecture. You have to watch it once, just deal." But yeah, I mean, that's everything. Oh, and just the way Joe Frank had those just loops. Oh, those loops were just sexy.
Yeah. Yeah. I know that's one thing, you know, in going through the manuscript, a lot of the material that I felt like maybe someday I could try and tackle, but I did, for this project, I knew I just wasn't up to it, was the really intense, the relationship stuff, the sexual stuff. It's in a way almost too too visceral, because I know that all of the material that was in the manuscript he sent me were in some way adapted from his shows. But for some of those more intense performances, I know so much of it hinged on the delivery of the actors he had working with him, and stuff that, like, the, you know, Rent-A-Family, another classic, where I'm trying to remember her name. The ex-wife is pleading frantically on the phone for her ex-husband, Arthur. And it's just the insane depravity in her voice. It is so chilling. I'm getting goosebumps just remembering that episode. And I don't know how on earth I could ever begin to try and turn that into a comic. But who knows, maybe down the road.
Yeah.
The stories I focused on mostly.
What?
Oh, sorry. The stories I focused on were mostly narration, cold narration, no dialogue.
Yeah.
Almost like silent. Yeah. Silent films.
Yeah. When you're in that pub and you do, and you draw, and you realize, all right, this is who I am in life. That's almost like, that's probably the realization, right?
It had to have been. Yeah.
Yeah. Then
it's clearer. It's clearer in retrospect.
Yeah. What was the first time that you were published? When did you get your first yes?
So my very first yes was for a website based in San Francisco called The Rumpus.
Oh, yeah. I used to write for them.
Yeah, that's the, you know, and that this was probably 2010.
Uh-huh.
And at that point, it really felt like there was a real community gathering around it. And I, you know, a lot of the people that were contributing were Bay Area people, and they would have gatherings. The irony, of course, is that at the time I was actually living in Albuquerque, so I didn't get to meet anyone. But I just, it felt like home because this is where I grew up. But that was all pro bono. And I was illustrating essays that they were publishing. It was great practice because at that point I still didn't have a real plan, but suddenly I found myself having to create images out of people's essays. And that was, I think, probably the best way to start out, even though it was unpaid, because the next thing that happened was a paid gig from the Poetry Foundation. And that I knew whatever I did, I knew was going to have a literary quality to it. I didn't go to the comic book publishers until much later.
Then, yeah, I wrote pro bono for the Rumpus too. And then, and then when you do the Rumpus readings, they're all pro bono, but they charge like, they used to do them at the Makeout Room. It was a $10 cover charge. And, yeah. and I got to say, it blows my mind. This used to blow my mind and piss me off so much. Cause whenever I put a reading together, all the writers were paid every single time. And all these readings I did where there was a $10 cover charge and you're not getting any of the money. Just, I felt like a whore. I felt like a dirty whore to the Rumpus.
That was one of their themes though. I feel like that was actually a whole genre for them.
True. Yeah, that's funny. Before I got off on that tangent there, then yeah, but at the same time, the Rumpus put a lot of eyes on me. I could put, this was the Rumpus published this, and they'd be like, "Oh my God, that's huge!" And I'd just be like, "No, you don't know how huge it is. It's not." but yeah, they had a jam.
Well, I mean, but I remember, yeah, Roxane Gay started there. Sugar, help me with her real name. I think of her,
Cheryl Strayed.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah. I mean, and it seemed like a lot of the people that were writing for the Rumpus had careers behind them that had gone for, years, sometimes decades. The Rumpus seemed to be the catalyst that really launched them into stardom.
Yeah.
And what I noticed was that there would even seem to be this trend where the Rumpus was the jumping point to the legacy media. Suddenly people were in the New Yorker or whatever. And the thing about the Rumpus though, is the way I found it was that the stuff I was interested in just happened to, every time I would Google something, there would be a Rumpus article about it. And so I just knew that was where I wanted to be at that time.
Yeah. Did you get published in the New Yorker? Did I read that?
Yeah.
Right? Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. In fact, I think I actually did the first online exclusive comic there. They'd published comics in the magazine itself for years and years, but I know they were very slow to really integrate the internet into the New Yorker phenomenon. For a long time, they really dug their heels in. They wanted to be, they had this image that they were trying to protect. And at some point, the dam must have broke, because this was 2013. And again, I was working with a co-writer. It was Mike Duncan, who hosts the Revolutions podcast, he's a big baseball fan. And it was the beginning of baseball season. So he had this thing, it was kind of just like an idea, and it quickly turned into a comic, and the New Yorker had been on my roster of people who reject me. So I sent it to them, and suddenly they were ready to publish this thing online. And I remember the reason I think it was the first is because I haven't seen anything older than it. And they sent the contract to us, someone had actually gone in with a ballpoint and scratched out the normal terms and drawn in the new online template, basically. That was my start at the New Yorker. I published a couple other cartoons online, and then there was one issue of the magazine where I got the spot illustrations, which is, the little cartouches of narrative pictures that are throughout the magazine.
Yeah.
That was kind of the high point. And at that point, I just, one of the things about especially comics, if you have pictures and words, at the New Yorker has a, there's like a whole, there are like level boss editors. Once you get the art approved, then someone else who does the words has to approve that. And then there's some other higher editor who has to approve the whole thing. And so what I found a lot of times was I'd get through one hoop and then crash and burn before the next one. And at some point I thought, I'm just killing myself trying to do this. And it's, and again, you know, it's prestigious to get your name in there, but at the same time, it doesn't actually translate into champagne dinners.
Yeah, true. That's so yeah, you did the little drawings that are just that, it's the story through the magazine, right?
Right. And mine happened to be baseball players.
Oh, that's awesome. What was it like buying that issue? Did you go buy that issue when it came out?
Yeah, that was actually agony because there's quite a bit of lead time, you know, way ahead of schedule that it's going to be in an upcoming issue. And I think in my case, it was probably like 6 months out. So I was just, you know, that was blistering to be, basically the bookstores in the area were getting tired of seeing me just go in and look at the magazine rack every day.
Did they tell you what issue it was going to be in, or you just,
yeah, I knew. Oh, okay. The thing is with distribution and the way the way magazines end up on racks, there's not like it's not very coordinated.
Yeah.
And so I didn't want to, you know, you do get contributor copies, but that's not as satisfying as being able to like walk into a bookstore and go, oh, what's this? Look, I happen to be in here, you know.
So when you got the magazine at the bookstore, how shamelessly self-promoting were you when you went and bought it?
I actually really embarrassed about that stuff. I bought a couple issues, but I didn't want them to know why I was doing it.
Really?
I was actually a little bit embarrassed. Yeah. It's weird. It's like I had my moment, but on some level I'm too self-conscious. You know, there's the part of there's the egomaniac inside that I try to keep in the jar because it's not necessarily pretty. So, you know, on the one hand, I wanted the glory of being able to walk into the bookstore and see this thing. But on the other hand, I didn't want to seem shameless. So I was like, I'm working on two ends. And again, that's another part of the submission process that's very exhausting, is when you get accepted and then the tortured psychology leading up to publication.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, and then everything that happens after publication, which includes, I mean, like there's a certain sort of expectation you have about the kind of impact you think your work might make on the world. And most of the time, I mean, this is true for 99.8% of the creative population. No one's really looking. So it's you always, again, you know, when you're a kid, especially, you think about like books seem like these holy things that they're just like filled with gravity, and it just seems like the people who make books are just these titans, especially the kind of childhood I had in, you know, Concord at the time was kind of a working class place. It wasn't like I was jumping from literary salon to salon, you know. It was just like I was just kids on the schoolyard beating each other up. If I'd said I liked poetry, I would have gotten beaten up again, you know. So it was really but to get to a place where you kind of see the internal workings, and you also realize as an adult that, you know, people are too busy just trying to live their lives to stop and rubberneck something like a literary magazine. That's the only people who read literary magazines are people who are trying to get into them.
Yeah. I mean, the New Yorker is a sexy one to put on your bio, though. Published in the New Yorker. I mean, I would have had that the minute I would have signed the contract. All of my web presence and everything would have said New Yorker. They would have thought that I got a job at the New Yorker, and it was just...
Yeah, it's up and down for me. Sometimes I think it's an asset. Sometimes I think it's a liability. And you know, somewhere like that where there's a look they try to cultivate. So they really want people who are going to enhance their brand, basically. So you can kind of be pigeonholed. And I see that happen, not just there, but in any place where they have kind of a house look. And obviously the paycheck is very enticing. But it, you kind of get locked in after a while, and you're not growing anymore. You've become a company person in a way.
So what do you do about that to get out of that mold?
Well, at this point, I don't submit really anything to magazines or newspapers anymore. I mean, part of that has to do with the fact that that media landscape is really in turmoil now. It was never very gainful. There was never a year where I didn't have to also have a full-time job, but now it is really bad. And I don't have numbers, but I know, you know, obviously I have a lot of colleagues and cohorts, so to speak, in that industry, and no one's having a good time. It is a real grind right now. I know that, you know, the New Yorker in particular, they've unionized, the staff is unionized. And right now they're going through heated negotiations. It's no one feels safe or secure. It's really bad. So at this point, I've resigned myself to my day job, and I'm just thinking about the books. Because those, and at the end of the day, those are the things that really matter anyway. Those are the ones that are not going to fall apart after a couple of years, you know?
Exactly.
So that's where it's.
Wait, what's your day job?
I work at a grocery store.
Oh, what do you do?
Well, in the morning, early morning, because it's the opening shift. So I get there around 4 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. And the first thing I do is unload trucks. I operate the forklift.
Well, how cool.
Once the store is open, I jump into a hybrid job where the first 4 hours I'm wrecking my body, and then the second 4 hours I'm exhaustedly trying to paint signs.
but if you work at Trader Joe's,
it you know that instinct to, I do, yeah.
Yeah, the illustrators. The illustrators at Trader Joe's are fantastic.
A lot of them are kind of in the same boat as me. You know, there's a guy I work with at my store that he's in the middle of producing an animated cartoon that's really good. It seems like it's ready for Adult Swim. But it's not that unusual. It seems like in a way that department at these stores has become a haven for people who maybe 10 years ago would have in a healthier publishing environment would have already, you know, been on their way to a career. So yeah, we're on the raft together.
Yeah. You know, I got to tell you, I mean, I, the Trader Joe's I go to is in Silver Lake in Los Angeles, and the almost everyone knows who the illustrator is. I can't remember his name, but I'm following him on Instagram because the guy's fantastic. And he just has this theme, and it's so cool. And I almost feel like those Trader Joe's, I mean, those are in your face, and they're creative. They let you be creative a bit.
It's probably my biggest audience at this point. I think more people see the signs I make just shopping at one store than anyone ever did at any magazine or newspaper I was ever published in.
Trader Joe's illustrators are the new New Yorker comics.
Don't let it get out too much.
What do you mean?
Well, space is limited.
Oh, right.
There'll be an army of creatives are going to start ransacking the Trader Joe's.
Oh my God! If the drawings at Trader Joe's went freelance instead of in house.
I mean, if there was a way of measuring how many units each of those signs is moving, and I could get a commission, that would be something.
How many signs do you have to create a week? Is there like, do they have a certain amount where they're expecting output?
Yeah, there is kind of a boilerplate description where like X number of minutes for a certain sized sign. And then obviously you can spend more time on the billboards, and we have, you know, a full range of different color paints, markers and things like that to work on a large scale. I like to do a lot of 3D stuff. So when we're breaking pallets down in the morning, I'll grab all the empty boxes and paint them to look like giant versions of the products. stuff like that. But where I really thrive in that role is with the small little shelf signs, because they're basically like comics panels. And so the store is full, in a way, it's almost like a giant comics miscellany. Unfortunately, it's all proprietary, so I can't take it to a publisher.
But you can, do you take photos of all your work?
I do, yeah. And blast them on Twitter or whatever.
Do you have an Instagram account I can follow? I want you to publish them on Instagram, just for me.
I do, actually, yeah.
Okay. Sure. What's your Instagram account?
Yeah, I do have an Instagram account. One word, commercial failure.
That's brilliant. That's a good one. You're going to have a new follower right after we're done recording. Hopefully a few
right
more.
Right on.
But there's a beauty to that. It's just, we're in such weird times. Publishing just tanks. I mean, I used to write for the San Francisco Chronicle, and I did my last article for them in 2015. And last few years, you know, I was freelancing, but I was writing 6 articles a month for them. And those last few years, I'm like, this is just depressing. I want out of this. I want out. I want out. And then finally, they had a really crappy managing editor who was just a terrible person that I got bumped up to because my last editor got laid off. And I was just like, you're a complete piece of crapola. I'm out. And I want to tell you why you're a piece of crapola. And then he ended up, I got to tell him through email and trying to call him. He was avoiding my calls because he did the stupid, he was a nut. Anyway, so I couldn't wait to go up there and tell him to his face because I was living in LA at the time. I'm like, next time I'm up there, I cannot wait to see this guy. Cause I'm scheduling a meeting with him and we're going to hash it out. He died.
Oh no.
And I was like, oh, opportunity lost.
I've done one cartoon for the Chronicle and I can't believe this. I don't even actually remember what it was about. I just know that in one panel, there is a toilet in the background. There's nothing in it. It's just a toilet. The only point of there being a toilet there is that there's a toilet. It's not gross or anything. And they made me take it out. They said it was inappropriate. A toilet.
So, but you put a really phallic looking symbol in another.
I should have. At that point, I think I just wanted the job to be over.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, that's how they get you. Again, that exhaustion of jumping through the hoops. So by the time you're there, you're just, at that point, it's like, you're just wearing your knuckles. That told me don't go there again.
Yeah. Well, what was funny with this one editor who died, so that, you know, they have to do a profile on it, the profile, obligatory profile obituary for the managing editor. Right. And all the people can say about it and all they had in there was he had a cat and he enjoyed the arts. Was nothing else. Or no, he contributed to the arts.
But,
and I'm like, it says it all right there, what a kind of human he was. You know, you read between the lines on those things, it's like that's all you can get out of the thing. All right. But you could have just waited a little longer because I wanted to chew him out in person, you know?
He could sense it.
I hope so. I should go to a seance and just be like, call up the managing editor of the Chronicle that died here.
Well, I had a similar experience. Maybe you were involved with them too, the Bay Citizen.
Oh no, but I know who they are, but I never worked with them.
The guy who started it was the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass guy.
Okay.
And when he died, the ownership of the Bay Citizen went to his next of kin, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So that was the end of that. But for a couple of years, the Bay Citizen, they were an insert in the New York Times. I was getting regular gigs from the Bay Citizen, like assignments. I didn't even have to do any thinking. They'd say, go to this event and draw it.
Wow.
And, yeah, it was really, that was so fantastic. And so I wanted that guy to stay alive.
Yeah.
But he didn't. So.
Oh, that is so cool. And then, I mean, the New York Times back, I used to get the New York Times religiously on Sundays until about 5 years ago. And it just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah. Yeah. I think at some point they got rid of the insert because even that was like too costly. Hiring some guy to throw that in the middle of the paper was too much of an investment.
The paper boys, I used to do the San Francisco Examiner. When I was about 11 years old, I had a paper out, and back in those days, the papers were heavy because it was a lot. I remember
when I was a kid, getting the exam, but the Sunday Examiner was like you could stop bullets with it. It was so big.
Yeah.
Mostly ads.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and then the ads for the advertising in the Macy's catalog that they used to have for the lingerie.
Right.
That got me through being 12 to 15.
My understanding is that all of this went away because of Craigslist, that advertising was actually key to the health of the paper. And once classifieds were something you could do online without any fees, that was the end of what we think of as traditional print journalism.
That Craig.
The beginning of the end.
Do you know where Craig lives?
Yeah,
I know where he lives.
He's such a nice guy, too.
I know he is.
I don't think that was his intention, but.
No, he's the biggest sweetheart in the world, but he took the whole newspaper industry down. it's kind of like how things change. Some things just need to go away and new things come up. And
yeah, I've gotten to a point where I just make my peace with these things. So like I said, I don't further my heartache anymore in trying to pursue that kind of career. And now it's really just the books, which I built into it is the understanding that these aren't necessarily going to ever sell. My interests aren't the kind that are blockbuster interests. I'm never going to do a cat book. So I just have to make my peace with knowing that a few copies get out there. And really my personal goal is to just try and fill up one shelf at home of my own stuff. And if I can do that, well, then that there's this modest thing I've satisfied.
I had an author, Adam Mansbach, on the show when I was in San Francisco and we did it in studio, probably around 2008 on Drinks with Tony. And then he goes to publish Go the F to Sleep, that children's book.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Okay.
And then it's millions upon millions of copies. And that's not what he's known for. He was writing these novels that were great. And then that comes out of nowhere, you know, and I mean, his name alone is carrying Akashic Books for probably the next two decades. What a great hit they made. And Akashic does really good with her, with their royalties. It's not like Akashic's taking advantage of him. He's also getting a very good fair share of it. Not that I know personally. I just know Akashic as a publisher has a very different royalty rate than most publishers.
That's great. I know Gary Thompson.
I'm sorry.
A writer editor here in Oakland named Jerry Thompson who sort of oversaw the Oakland Noir collection.
That's how
I know Akashic because of their noir. The Noir City series.
The Noir. Wait a second.
It's good. I'm glad to hear.
I got Palm Springs Noir right here. I'm interviewing the editor of that in a few weeks. Yeah.
Yeah, see, I think they're going everywhere. They're going to hit every city they can.
They're going deep. They're going to have Concord Noir. You'll have to edit that one for them.
That was a dark town.
Yeah.
When I go back there now, it's turning into another Walnut Creek. But
yeah.
When I was a kid, it was rough. I mean, it was steam fitter people. I imagine the refinery is still responsible for a lot of business, but when I was a kid, maybe it was just being young too, but those hot summers, like 100 degrees, no school, just walking around, I felt like I'm going to get jumped any minute. I'm just ready for this. I don't feel like that there now. I have kids. I take them to Concord sometimes, and I feel like it's like Broadway Plaza or something. It's not
right.
It's not noir anymore. But if they do a noir collection for Concord, they've got to find people that were there in the 80s.
Yeah, and I remember as a kid in Millbrae that Concord was always about 10 or 15 degrees hotter. If it was a hot day, if you were in Concord, it was
the Diablo Valley.
Yeah. Did I see I had a question and I looked into your eyes and I got lost for a second. When you were when you lived in Concord, were you a fan of the Oakland A's or the San Francisco Giants?
You know, I wasn't really into baseball as a kid.
Okay.
I didn't know my dad growing up. And that's really that's how you get into baseball. There's a dad that's kind of, you know, ushering you into it. And so it wasn't until I was in my 30s that I started cultivating an interest in baseball. I ended up doing a whole book about it, an illustrated book, and it's something that I take my kids to now, or at least I did before the pandemic. It was something that I wanted to get into for a long time, if for no other reason, because it was such a great way to connect with people, break ice. So I kind of approached it as an anthropologist. I've always enjoyed going to ball games, the experience of being in the bleachers and the crowds and the excitement. Even if I wasn't interested in the game, I just liked the phenomenon of people being there. And so over time, by kind of absorbing that first, I finally got into a place where I could actually like sort of follow the game and really be involved and interested in that way. The book I did is a history book.
The dead ball. You did the dead ball book.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
If I had to pick a team, it would be the A's. And one of the things I like about them is that they blow it every year, which keeps the price going down.
Yeah. That used to be the thing with the Giants, because I was on the peninsula. So the A's felt like so far away, but it was the San Francisco Giants at Candlestick. And they were losing all the time, and it was beautiful. When we won in 2010, though, that was one of the, I mean, that moment of like, we were never supposed to win the World Series. How did this happen? It was hilarious. The other ones weren't interesting, but that 2010 one, I was living on Geary Street, and the whole city just went to a shutdown when they won that last game. So,
were you in San Francisco for 89?
I was living in Fremont for 89 when they when the earthquake happened. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I was actually in Sunnyvale visiting my grandparents, pretty close to the epicenter.
Yeah.
I remember the shoe store that we were in. We were buying shoes, and the whole front of the store was glass, and I just remember the entire building shaking like suddenly we were on the bed of a pickup truck or something. And my grandmother, it seems like she'd been waiting her whole life for this to happen. She yelled, "Here it comes!" And she grabbed me and threw me to the ground like a grenade was going to go off.
That was nuts. My parents had just bought a house, and I was watching the whole garage buckle and the cars bounce up and down in the street. It was surreal.
Yeah,
at least we weren't on what was that terrible freeway that came down in Oakland?
Oh yeah, that, I think that was 880, the old 880. Yeah,
that was brutal. That was such a weird time.
It was, yeah.
Yeah,
that was the Joe Frank era.
I know. It was good fun. Jason, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Jason Novak on Drinks with Tony. Check out his new book, illustrated. The book he illustrated. The book's called Joe Frank Ascent, and Jason Novak illustrated the book. It's fantastic. Next week on the show, we have Michael Elias. He will be discussing his new book, and also he wrote he's written a lot for Steve Martin. His film credits include The Jerk, and he was the creator of the TV series Head of the Class. I bet that guy's got stories. We're going to find out next week. Thanks for listening. And if you would like to join my free writing workshop at the Los Angeles Public Library on April 14th, go to lapl.org, search for events happening on April 14th, and you'll find out how to sign up for the 6 p.m. creative writing workshop. You don't need to have a library card. You can dial in from anywhere now that we're still on the Zooms. I'll see you next week on Drinks with Tony. Thanks for listening to Drinks with Tony. You are on your radio dial at 101.9 FM KPCR LP Santa Cruz.